Great news for the world. Chapter 1. First, the bad news. Sometimes, when I am playing with my 3-year-old granddaughter, a lump comes into my throat, and I think of words spoken by Sir Winston Churchill some 20 years ago. The British government had decided to go ahead with the manufacture of hydrogen bombs. Some members of Parliament were opposed to this, and a debate took place in the House of Commons. Prime Minister Churchill made a speech defending his decision, in which he said to a hushed chamber, "What ought we to do? Which way can we turn to save our lives and the future of the world? It does not matter so much to old people. They're going soon, anyway. But I find it poignant to look at youth in all its activity and ardour, and most of all to watch little children playing their merry games, and wonder what would lie before them if God wearied of mankind." Churchill was right. It is our little children who have the most to lose, and the prospect for their future is horrifying. The fearful weapons that he saw with his imagination are now reality. Britain, America, Russia, China, France, India, and Israel already belong to the World Suicide Club, membership open to all who possess atomic bombs, and other nations are queuing up to join. But the position today is even worse than Churchill feared. An explosive situation is developing all over the world because a horrifying new dimension has recently been added. Famine. No sensible nation would ever start a nuclear war, but hunger sometimes drives people to do crazy things. Shortages of everything except people. It simply had to happen, sooner or later. During the past 40 years, the world's population has doubled. That means 2,000 million extra mouths to feed. There would have been a disastrous famine long before, had it not been for one thing. During the same period, the world output of food has roughly doubled, too. But the world's farmers cannot keep on increasing their output like this. Their success over the past 40 years has been due to several factors. New land has been brought under cultivation. Dry areas have been made more productive by large-scale irrigation schemes. And the use of fertilizers and of agricultural machinery has been dramatically increased. Unfortunately, none of these advances can be repeated. There is hardly any more good agricultural land lying unused, waiting to be brought under cultivation. Most of the Earth's rivers have already been harnessed, so that there are already signs of a world shortage of water. Both fertilizers and fuel for farm machinery are scarce, and their prices have recently increased by several 100%. Far-sighted farmers are becoming increasingly concerned. Modern agriculture is totally dependent on the products of modern technology. These, in turn, depend upon the world's supplies of mineral resources, which are very limited. Fertilizers cannot be made without phosphates, but we have been mining the world's phosphates for years and years without a thought for the future, and now we're beginning to run short. To build tractors, you need metals like tin, zinc, platinum, and copper, and now we're gradually running out of those metals. To run tractors, you need oil, but the world's oil looks as if it will all be used up within a few tens of years. It's not surprising that world food production has been more or less at a standstill for the past 3 years. This means that the amount of food that barely fed the world's 3,800 million people in 1973 must be stretched to feed 4,000 million in 1976. And next year there will be another 75 million wanting a share, and a further 76 million the year after, and yet another 78 million the year after that. Thanks to pollution, even pure air and pure seawater are becoming scarce. Dr. Jacques Cousteau, the world's leading expert in oceanography, told a conference in 1975, "The oceans could be dead in less than 50 years. Ominously, he added, "Ecologists know very well that the human species cannot survive if the oceans die." These are the basic facts behind the economic problems facing Britain and the USA and every other nation today. Prices were bound to rise, and are bound to go on rising. Prices always do rise in times of shortage, and the world is short of nearly everything, except people. In the wealthier nations, rising prices will lead to inflation, or to increasing unemployment, or to a fall in our standard of living, or quite probably to all of these. In the poorer countries of Asia and Africa and Latin America, the effects will be far more disastrous. Hundreds of millions of their inhabitants are already spending almost their entire incomes on food. Rising prices can mean only one thing to them: starvation. The way we are going. No one can be sure what the next few years will bring. Only one thing is certain. Unless mankind can work out some sort of solution within the next few years, we shall all be facing catastrophe. Many Westerners are puzzled by the population explosion. Why, they ask, don't the famine-stricken nations of the Third World curb their fantastic population growth? There are three good reasons why they do not. In the first place, a population explosion is rather like a runaway train. There's no way to stop it suddenly. You can only slow it down gradually. 2/5 of the population in countries like India are under 15, compared with 1/5 in countries like Britain. This vast army of children will become parents themselves within a few years. Secondly, trying to persuade people in the Third World to limit their families is as soul-destroying a job as selling raincoats in the Sahara. Poverty-stricken peasants depend on their children to support them in old age. Naturally, they're all determined to have as many children as possible. Finally, many Afro-Asian governments resent even the suggestion that they should solve the world crisis by controlling their own populations. They fail to see why they should take drastic steps of this kind, just so that the wealthiest 1/3 of the world can go on consuming 2/3 of the world's food and resources. As they see it, there's only one fair way of tackling the problem. They think there ought to be a drastic redistribution of the world's wealth. In other words, that we Europeans should deliberately reduce our living standards so that they can increase theirs. This may seem a monstrous impertinence to us, but everything depends upon one's point of view. To the man in the rice paddy, it sounds a perfectly reasonable suggestion, on indulging our apparently limitless appetite for food and comfort. so the vicious circle remains unbroken. The tropical nations cannot and will not reduce their enormous rate of population growth. The wealthy nations will not voluntarily reduce their extravagant use of the Earth's limited resources. The situation calls for coordinated, unselfish action by every nation and every individual, but there's not the slightest hope that this will happen. Countdown to catastrophe. Meanwhile, time is running out. Every time the clock ticks, the world's population is increased by 2. 10,000 additional hungry mouths join us every hour. There's no longer any question as to whether a major world disaster is coming. The only questions are when and what form it will take. Will our economic system stand up to the increasing strains being placed upon it? Can our democratic way of life survive, or will social unrest and violence escalate into revolution? Will the population problem be solved eventually by 100 million people starving to death each year, or by the horrors of an all-out nuclear war? Increasing numbers of influential sources are now giving gloomy answers to questions like these. In 1975, the leading British newspaper, The Observer, began an article which was afterwards reproduced as a wisely circulated booklet with these words: "We and our children are approaching a world of mounting confusion and horror. The next 25 years, possibly the next decade, will bring starvation to hundreds of millions, and hardship, disorder, or war to most of the rest of us. Democracy, where it exists, has little chance of survival. Nor, in the longer run, has our industrial way of life. There will not be a better tomorrow beyond our present troubles." Frightening though the Observer's predictions may be, other writers are even more pessimistic. Some are afraid that the famous last prophecy of the futurist writer H.G. Wells will soon be proved true. "This world is at the end of its tether. The end of everything we call life is close at hand and cannot be evaded. There is no way out or round or through the impasse. It is the end." Happily, it can be said with absolute certainty that Wells was wrong in his conclusion. So are all the present-day prophets of doom. This is not to say that they overestimate the dangers facing mankind. The situation is indeed desperate. The problems confronting our generation are quite beyond our ability to solve. An appalling disaster really is looming up ahead of us, and there is nothing that we can do to avert it. But the doom-mongers generally overlook one vital fact. 2,000 years ago, when the human race was sunk in obscenity and wickedness, someone called Jesus of Nazareth came to the world's aid. He only taught for about 4 years, but he changed the whole course of human history, and he left behind him a promise that one day he would come to the world's rescue a second time, when all mankind was in dire need of his help. This is not wishful thinking. As we shall see in the next chapter, it is plain, well-attested historical fact that he made this promise. And as chapter 3 will show, there is a great deal of compelling evidence that his promise will be fulfilled soon. Truly, this is great news for the world.